machine learning and AI in general, you know, has the capability to revolutionize the way we think about the world.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Goldman, and this is Future Proof. So today, we're talking to consumer behavior expert and prolific author Michael Solomon. As you can probably tell, I'm losing my voice as I record this intro. I still had it during the actual interview, thank God. So I'm going to let Michael do his own intro, and we'll put in the show notes as well. But this is a great conversation where we talk about robotics adoption curve, the possible negative impact of emerging technologies like AI and automation, what consumer behavior will look like in the future, and even how he feels about cheesesteaks. So let's jump right in.
Alrighty, so Michael, welcome to Future Proof. I want to first, I guess, ask you, what is your name, what's your title, and what the heck do you do on a day-to-day basis?
Okay, so my name is Michael Solomon, and my title is a professor of marketing in the Haub School of Business at St. Joseph's University in Philadelphia. So I am a full-time faculty member, just on the verge of final exams, so not looking forward to that, but hoping for redemption in a few weeks. And when I'm not teaching, I teach both undergraduates and graduate students. And when I'm not teaching, I'm spending most of my time writing and traveling around doing keynotes, talking about trends in consumer behavior and why we shop and that sort of thing. And that's what I do.
Great. So, and I really wanted to jump into it because I had a lot of interesting, or I don't want to say interesting questions, but topics that I think you have interesting perspectives on. One thing that we like to ask a number of different people who've come on here before is, how do you define innovation? What is innovation and what is it not?
Well, that's an interesting question. And I would come at that, as I do most things, from the point of view of the receiver of the innovation, not the creator of the innovation. And so in our discipline of consumer behavior, we essentially define an innovation as anything the consumer perceives to be new. And that's, I probably diverges a bit from your normal working definition, because what that means is there are many existing products or services out there that still can be classified as an innovation because they haven't yet been experienced by people in different markets. So, something could be in use in, let's say, Europe for 10 years, and for whatever reason in the United States, people aren't familiar with it, that means it's still considered to be an innovation, even though it might be a relatively mature product elsewhere.
Yeah, and I think that that's true. And I think that, you know, a lot of it really has to do with who you're talking to. And that's something that, you know, especially given that you, I know, keynote and speak all over, how do you meet people kind of where they're at? How do you try to talk to people about what the future is going to entail at a different level, depending on where they are at, within a certain adoption curve?
The easiest way to do it is just to ask them. In other words, you know, it's usually helpful just to come right out and say, what do you think is new? What's going on in your world or in your culture that is getting people talking? What do you see is on the horizon? What sort of consumer trends can you identify? And of course, to try to look for some kind of consensus across people that you talk to, because you don't want to base your conclusions on an audience of one, or even, you know, as one thing I found in my career is the alarming number of times a company makes pretty big decisions based on the results of one focus group of, say, 8 housewives. And, that can be enlightening, but definitely not definitive.
Yeah. And actually, speaking of definitive, we always like to jump in towards the beginning with a little lightning round.
Ready as I'm going to get.
So, okay, since you're a Philly guy, favorite cheesesteak of choice? Are you a, you know, Gino's guy or what?
Well, that's a loaded question around here. Gino is a personal friend of mine, so I have to be politically correct and say, yeah, but you know what? There's plenty of great cheesesteak places all around. I don't think it's such a great innovation to chop up some meat and put it in a bun. So maybe I'm not a typical, I'm not a lifelong native of Philly, so I'm a little more irreverent about cheesesteaks. But sure, you can't go wrong with Geno's or Pat's, and that's where all the tourists go. So be prepared to wait online.
Yep, absolutely. I think I know the answer to this, but how many books have you written?
I'm not quite sure, actually, but probably around 20 or so.
Okay, the number I had was 21, but hey, you know, I think it's a sign that you're an author when you don't know how many books you've actually written.
Well, I'll take your word for it. That's good to know. I'll make a note of that.
That's funny. And since I know you've spoken just about all over, what's your favorite place to speak if you had to pick?
Wow. You know, I really enjoy, I speak in Europe a fair amount, and I really enjoy being over there. I love to go to other countries because so many of the stereotypes that American marketers have about how business is done elsewhere are really inaccurate, and it's fascinating to see that in some places they really are behind the curve, but in other places very much ahead of us. It's a little bit discouraging sometimes to see how far ahead they are, but it's fascinating to see where people are in different parts of the world, even within Europe, you know, Southern Europe versus Northern Europe, and so on.
That's so true. And speaking about innovations and some that are a little bit behind others, are you an iPhone or Android guy?
Oh, I'm an Apple guy all the way.
The power of you know, manipulating consumer behavior. I totally hear that. And what is something you've never admitted to in an interview previously?
Ooh,
can be anything about yourself.
Okay, well, I guess one thing I'll admit to, if no one promises to tell my dean, is that I'm a professor in a business school and have been for many years, but I never actually took a business course. I was a psychology graduate student and made the move directly into a MBA, teaching MBAs, but had never taken anything like finance and accounting and so on.
I wish that I would have spoken to you maybe 20 years earlier and I could have avoided a lot of pain, but I think that's actually a pretty good one. I wanted to kind of jump back into things because I know that you have a mantra that I find very interesting. We don't buy products because of what they do. We buy them because of what they mean. And I think that's obviously relevant to your answer about Apple before, but is that a statement that will be true forever, or are we at a particular moment in time where that's true?
I think it will be true for a long time, and in fact, probably getting more true every day, because part of what I mean by that is, you know, in many categories, and manufacturers hate to hear this, but the reality is in many categories, whether it's true or not, consumers don't see a lot of differences among brands in terms of their technical capabilities. And that can be very discouraging when you know that you've got the greatest, you know, shiny object. But really the distinctions that they're making, unless they're really a connoisseur of, let's say, stereo equipment or something like that, the distinctions they're making are in terms of the meaning of that product, the backstory of it, who that product is identified with, et cetera. And so, you know, if you look at the market leaders in just about any category, and certainly probably any consumer facing category, what you see is that they're really ahead of the number threes and fours and fives in that category, but not because people love them for their functionality, but rather because they've succeeded in creating such a compelling brand narrative that's what people are buying into. And as we continue to progress technologically, it seems to me anyway, that those differences, those technical differences, will become even smaller. Now I'm not counting some great leap forward, like some brand new technology that only one company, you know, is responsible for. I'm talking about in relatively mature markets. I think the differences get smaller and smaller, and therefore the marketer's job gets more and more challenging, but also much more central to the survival of the brand, because the differences that you make are much more subjective than they are objective.
Yeah, and I think that makes a lot of sense, especially when you consider the fact that, you know, you touched upon this before, that in your travels, you kind of start to understand people a little bit more as you're traveling. I know that you've given lectures across the U.S., Scandinavia, U.K., Australia, Latin America, you name it. Is consumer behavior in all those different markets innately the same, or are there differences, based off of where they are, with respect to the adoption curve?
Well, at the 30,000 foot level, we're all the same, we're all people. And of course, the more you travel, and I'm sure you've had the same experience, you're struck by how similar people are, regardless of what language they speak and so on. And so people at the very basic level, where, marketers are supposed to function, and that is satisfying needs, we're all the same. Now, here we get into that old, dichotomy or distinction between needs versus wants. And so we all have the same needs, the need to be admired, the need to be loved, the need to master our environment, and on and on. Now, the way that we choose to do that, at the tactical level, if you will, that's where the wants come in. And of course, that's where culture plays such an enormous role. So at that more immediate level or molecular level, clearly consumer behavior is quite different. And really, the marketing graveyard is littered with brands that don't get that people, that just because a formula that they've mastered in one market, if that's successful, they think they can just transplant that elsewhere and everybody's going to accept that. And we can all point to many, many examples where that just isn't the case.
Yeah, I think, and I was talking with somebody the other day about just thinking about the translations and the localizations. There are certain things, the Chevy Nova, doesn't go or won't go, whatever that is. And so many other examples where people just don't pay attention to the fact that people are very similar, and yet there are differences, and those differences need to be respected. So I'm wondering, especially given the fact that our world is becoming more and more connected, travel will be easier and people will relocate. Are we just going to see more of a hodgepodge where consumer behavior will wind up being even more similar from one market to another, just because those markets are going to be touching each other more on an ongoing basis?
Yeah, that is a really great question. And I think you can answer it in in two opposite ways and probably be right, because clearly we do see homogenization. Wherever you travel, you see kids wearing Nike logos and so on. And so we are seeing, as multinationals, now, of course, hopefully they're going to localize their campaigns, but brands like Coca-Cola, Marlboro, McDonald's, they're pretty pervasive. And that's leading to what we sometimes refer to as a global consumer culture. So really, although there are many differences, and, as you point out, the language differences, et cetera, ironically, what happens is that the brand we speak, or the language we speak, excuse me, is brands, so in the old days, there was a language called Esperanto. You may have heard of that,
where, oh, yeah,
people were advocating a universal language requiring no translations. We can see where that went. But I would argue that branding is the Esperanto of our current eras. But having said that, we're also seeing some pushback there. And we're seeing that people are craving more individualization and more of a reflection of local culture. So again, you kind of have it operating at two levels. So at a very broad level, you've got your general brand identity. Let's take Starbucks as an example. At this point, pretty much everywhere in the world, maybe a few countries they haven't entered yet. So you've got that global brand platform that is fairly similar, and that, and when you're traveling, people are going to look for the comfort of a Starbucks logo or even a McDonald's logo to make them feel like something is familiar. But when you get down to the more minute level, you look at the design elements in within a particular Starbucks outlet, and you'll see that many of them now are moving away from a very homogenized design and incorporating more local elements, in some cases using local artists, local designers, and so on. So, it's very similar to the old but still important, controversy. If you're a global advertiser, should you standardize your advertising or should you localize it? And so, the answer is both. You need to standardize it at a very broad level so that the brand meaning is consistent, but the way you express that brand in local markets should definitely change. So, I think the other thing that's feeding into this, and maybe this isn't as positive, but, the growing trend toward nationalism that we're seeing in many countries, including our own, where people are, or at least some people are kind of rejecting the idea of an international culture and really trying to return to the, quote, good old days, if they ever existed, where their culture was dominant. And so that's probably a force that's going to work, at least in the short term, against that kind of localization that other people seem to be looking for.
Yeah, no, and I think that that's, I hadn't really thought about it that way, but I think that, you're really talking about all these socioeconomic trends that come into play that are major factors. I'm also thinking about, obviously, the technologies and other things that are, on the more technological side. I know you've worked with some major brands to make them more consumer-centric. So what are the technologies and the other trends, socioeconomic and otherwise, that can help make brands more consumer-centric, particularly over the next few years?
Yeah, so we're really privileged to live in a time when all of these exciting technologies are taking off. Now they have, there's a little turbulence. There's obviously some very important ethical issues about privacy and, that's that sort of thing. And I don't mean to gloss over those, but the ability to instantly communicate with other people in almost every country, unless their government is censoring them, I think it is incredibly liberating. But it's also, it's unleashing a lot of power that I'm not sure we're prepared to deal with. And so in the short term, we're going to have to work that out. But to your question about how companies can harness that technology to better understand their consumers, one of the most exciting things about technology is, I guess, what's commonly called Internet 2.0. And we tend to forget that, until fairly recently, the internet was largely a one-way sort of thing, and the users, the listeners, the receivers were really not able to participate in the conversation. And I think younger people tend to take it for granted. But, I remember when basically, all you had was a static website and you went to it and you read some stuff and that was it. So the ability for the users to participate in the conversation and therefore the ability for companies to crowdsource customer insights using this technology is to me an amazing kind of potential, and one that I, in my opinion, most companies really haven't leveraged very well at this point. So I'll give you a concrete example. When we look at all my students, basically live on Instagram, and as these days you can't eat a meal unless you take a picture of it first, and you certainly can't date someone unless you change your relationship status on Facebook. It's just not done. And so people are posting so much content and so many images, and so many of these images are related to their consumption preferences. And so, in addition to doing traditional marketing research, you have this unbelievably immense amount of free data sitting there that is constantly being added to. I mean, literally second by second, millions of images are going up there. And so much of it has to do with how consumers view their lives and especially in an aspirational sense, where they think they want to go with these products. And yet companies are not, they're finally getting around to saying, well, we need to be on Instagram and push out our images to our customers. but they're not taking the opposite perspective and saying, what are they saying about our brand? How are they showing it in use? What other brands are they showing in use along with it? You know, what types of people are they envisioning would use the brand? And all, you know, many, many other questions that we can get the answers to today if we only focus, you know, our perspective that way. And trust me, we never had that capability until fairly recently. So it's incredibly exciting to me.
Yeah, I think it's I like that. That sounds actually very positive. And I think the way that I kind of approach all of this disruption right now, which is I know the Chinese proverb, may you live in interesting times, was not supposed to be a positive thing. It was technically a curse, but I don't really care. I'd rather live some time where there's a lot of disruption and interesting things happening, like the robotics wave now. I mean, Where do you think we are in the overall adoption curve with respect to robots?
Well, we're obviously, you know, pretty far to the left at this point. I think we're certainly starting to see maybe we're getting to the tipping point, or at least the first tipping point of this. You know, it's been fun to watch the extent to which people are even talking about robots and so on over the last couple of years. And, you know, you don't have to do tons of Google searches and analytics and so on just to see that people are much more conscious of this than they were even a couple of years ago. So, but having said that, of course, you know, there's a lot of negative press about that. And there's definitely a lot of pushback. And, you know, it's tempting to say we might see another, you know, Luddite revolution like we had in England in the 1800s, where people were destroying technology because they were afraid of it. There was a big news item that you may have seen about, you know, that Amazon has admitted that, yes, their employees do listen sometimes to people when they're talking to Alexa, or even when they're just talking in the room with an Alexa, you know, with an Echo. And news stories like that are not going to facilitate the innovation curve in any way. But, you know, you're, as I like to say, you're either on the train or under it. And, you know, there are so many fields where robotics or machine learning and AI in general, you know, has the capability to revolutionize the way we think about the world. And, you know, when you look at healthcare and productivity and all of those areas, once this gets started, again, you know, big ethical issues there, but hopefully we can get a handle on those. And if so, I think we're at an inflection point where our society is going to look very, very different, you know, in 10 or 20 years.
Yeah, I mean, I think that as you're looking at all of this, I mean, it's hard to say for anybody that it's not going to have a massive impact on our society. And, you know, it's just conducting an interview where we were talking about the idea that potentially it's overall two steps forward, one step back. So it's a net positive, but our society winds up being transformed in a way that, you know, it's going to be hard to imagine even. Does that look ultimately positive to you? Or are you concerned that people are not spending enough time thinking about some of the negative implications of some of the robotics and AI and automation revolution that's going on right now?
Well, I do think that, unfortunately, many of our politicians and policymakers are certainly not thinking enough about it. You know, some of them are hiding their head in the sand, and others, maybe they don't believe in it in the same way that they don't believe in climate change or something like that. But clearly, in the short term, we're going to see disruption in a very negative way. And that's, you know, in the form of displaced workers. There's no question about that. But those workers don't necessarily have to be harmed if we have a coherent policy that is focused, that recognizes that this is going to happen, tries to be more proactive about it, you know, by instituting various sorts of retraining programs, subsidies, and so on, that will allow these displaced workers to make a much smoother transition. And I don't see that happening. You know, I see people talking about the idea that truck drivers are going to be out of business pretty soon because self-driving trucks will be so commonplace. But I don't hear anybody talking about what we're going to do with all of those people who drive trucks.
Yeah, and I think that's actually touching upon a really important thing, which is that people do want to invest when they get close enough to, or people also want to try to solve a problem when they're getting closer to the problem. We, I think, as humans, and you would know this better than me from a psychological impact, it's just much harder to get people to focus on things that are further out. I mean, really, marketers and business people are thinking about, for instance, robotics, not in the long term, but in terms of how do we change the minds of consumers in the short term. Like, you have a lot of shoppers now that are increasingly interacting with machines instead of people. And I think that that's going to have massive ramifications for the way we think about marketing and sales interactions. That's simply happening simply because that's where the innovation is going and where people are, you know, spending their time and resources is finding robotics to solve consumer problems at retail. I mean, at least in my perspective, I've seen a lot there. So are there any examples of consumer-centric robot implementations that have impressed you or look like a portend of things to come?
Well, I think in general, companies are focusing more on the technological implementation and not so much on what you're very accurately describing as, you know, the potential pushback you're going to get, because we don't like to talk to machines. We like to, you know, it kind of flies in the face of what was considered to be a revolution in marketing just a few years ago. And that was what we call the era of relationship marketing, where many companies finally realized that they had to move away from a transactional kind of relationship with their customers, and that relationships and lifetime customer value, you know, building a long-term bond with your customer, that is the true path to profitability. And yet, ironically, now with the advent of some of these solutions that you're talking about, we're kind of stripping away all of that relationship aspect, all of the hard work that some of these companies have done to make themselves less mechanistic. Now they're going to move in the other direction. And I think you're right that we have a tendency to not want to confront things until it's a little bit too late. And, you know, as the saying goes, denial is not a river in Egypt. You know, it's people love to deny that this stuff is happening until they have to deal with it retroactively, you know. And I think we can do things. We can at least try to make machines more human. We can think about what is it that makes for a satisfying interpersonal interaction, and at least try to replicate some of those elements and do that a little more thoughtfully. And that even in terms of just looking at speech patterns, looking at the kinds of emotional information that is communicated in language. And so we know that linguists talk about something called paralanguage, which is basically all the information that's communicated when people are speaking, but not in the words themselves, you know, rather in the way those words are delivered. And so if you've got this robotic sounding Alexa there, you know, that really isn't going to do much to endear itself to people.
Yeah, I mean, actually, I wanted to ask you a little bit about one of those points that you just brought up, which is how much we want or don't want computers and robots to mimic us. We want, you know, to be able to relate to them, but not too much. And I mean, I think that the term that I think of is the uncanny valley. And do you mind explaining to our listeners, in essence, if they haven't heard about it, what the uncanny valley phenomenon is and what that realization should mean for marketers and technologists in terms of what direction we should be building these machines?
Well, sure. You know, the uncanny valley is a term that's been in use for some time, and it essentially refers to the realization that you know, people in robotics are working very hard to make robots that are extremely lifelike. And the same goes for movie makers, for example, who are making animated films and so on, and trying to make characters that look extremely human. And ironically, what they find is that up to a point, people really like that. But when it gets to the point where the character really looks human, there's pushback about that. And so there have been movies, for example, the Polar Express with Tom Hanks, where he voiced a character that looked extremely lifelike. You know, some people have said that movie didn't do as well as it could have because people were a little bit creeped out by that. So, maybe the lesson is that you don't want people to ever forget that they're conversing with a machine. And in fact, I think you have an ethical obligation to remind them of that, because people aren't always aware, you know, especially when they talk to something at a call center and people aren't able to tell whether it's a chatbot or it's a real person. But you do want to make it reasonably realistic. So, you know, it should be good, but not perfect.
It's such an interesting thing, you know, where the idea that for most things, we basically say they should be very low fidelity or high fidelity, and they should be on one side of the spectrum or the other. And really, with some of these assisted automated technologies that are coming out now, the answer is to be not necessarily in the middle, but certainly not to make it as quote unquote good as you can, which I find fascinating. And I think it's why your work in the intersection of consumer behavior and technology is so incredibly important. I mean, what do you think the impact of data? I mean, we've got dating apps, sex bots, and other smart devices. I mean, what impact do you think that that'll have on interpersonal relationships most likely?
Well, it's fascinating to speculate. And, you know, this idea of, you know, of sex bots and so on, you know, I think that there's, you know, you were asking earlier about innovation. And I think that over time, I think people need some time to get adjusted to this idea. And, you know, as with almost anything else, there's going to be different segments in the market. Some people are going to be much more readily adaptable to this, and others are going to fight it till the bitter end. But really, it's a slippery slope. And when you start to get used to this stuff and you accept the fact that a non-human can, in fact, be extremely lifelike, it gets easier and easier to do that. So to be honest with you, I'm not convinced that this uncanny valley phenomenon is going to persist over time. I think that it's more of a shock of the new sort of thing. And when you look at some of these sex bots, when you look at some avatars, you know, in computer environments, they're getting to the point where they're extremely realistic. And my sense is that people are going to pay a premium to have them as realistic as possible. So, it's an open question as to whether this uncanny valley phenomenon is something that's going to persist. It really was something that was talked about in the fairly early days of robotics, beginning, I believe, in the 1970s. And today we have, you know, we have representations that are extremely lifelike. And I'm not seeing that kind of pushback that you were seeing then. So I think it's just a matter of time, in the same way that, you know, people, we come to accept lots of things that we would have thought were really strange. So, you know, nowadays, when we see somebody walking down the street talking to themselves and, you know, and gesturing wildly, you know, in the old days, we thought that person just escaped from the asylum. But today we say, yeah, they're just talking on their phone.
See, and let me just interject, because it's interesting. That's something I've thought a lot about, where I'll get a lot of my writing done and inevitably at Starbucks. And I can't help but notice that even though I'm aware of these technologies and I've lived with, you know, cell phones for quite a while, you know, good percentage of my life, certainly all of my adult life, inevitably it comes across as more annoying to me to hear a one-sided conversation at Starbucks because somebody's on the phone rather than when they're sitting with somebody. And you would know this better than me, so please correct me if I'm wrong. I think that part of us can get used to new technologies, but there are a few innate things, such as the, you know, lizard brain inevitably still thinks that people are crazy when they're talking to themselves. And that's why, even though I'm used to the technology, I still find it more annoying to only hear one side of a conversation in public rather than both sides. And so essentially that there are certain things you can get used to, but then there are also certain things that make us innately human that we're not going to necessarily, unless we biohack them out, we're still going to react to certain things in certain ways.
Well, you know, part of that I can't argue with, because you've hit on one of my major pet peeves. I can't stand listening to other people's conversations. But what I'm talking about is how we interpret that behavior. So we're not interpreting it as that guy is crazy. We're interpreting it as that guy's incredibly rude and he's intruding on my space. So he very much knows what he's doing. It's not that he's not in control of his faculties. It's that he's deliberately, you know, he's got to be aware that he's bugging other people and he's doing it anyway. And I think that's what's getting you angry. You know, in the old days, you would be sympathetic and say, oh, that poor person needs to be institutionalized right away. And, you know, he needs help. And today it's more like that person really needs to be talked to and, you know, take his phone away. Whether it becomes an accepted norm, you know, it's certainly much more acceptable today. You know, I was personally really, really alarmed when they started talking about the idea of permitting cell phone conversations on airplanes. To me, that would be the ultimate living hell. But the idea that they're even considering that, to me, reflects a kind of a sea change in our culture in terms of how we accept that sort of thing. And again, more generally, you know, do we like it? Maybe not. But, you know, when we look at the number of people who get into car accidents, who are run over by, you know, as pedestrians because they're texting on their phones when they're crossing the street, we see that that's a change in behavior that has to be dealt with in some way. But it's not something that we had to deal with, you know, 10 years ago.
Last thing I want to ask you, because I think what's interesting is you have a dispassionate, in a good way, I think, view towards predicting and forecasting, where it seems like you do your best to try to figure out what direction things are going. And certainly you have a point of view and you would like things to turn out a certain way, but it's not always possible to, you know, lead things in the direction you'd like them to go. Oftentimes you're just predicting where they are going to go. So kind of wondering, how do you, when you're trying to forecast the next few years, how do you correct for your own biases? How do you separate out what you want to happen versus what you think will actually occur?
Well, that's the million-dollar question, isn't it? You know, we all bring our biases to the table. And I guess that, you know, one answer to that is triangulation. In other words, try to avoid relying only on one source of data, whether that's just your personal observations or whether it's actual numbers from somewhere. You know, try to use two or three different sources of information and see if there's some coherence there. And again, ask people. In other words, you know, a lot of times I find that people in business, they may be very astute and they may, you know, great creative designers and so on, but they have a certain conceit that they think they understand their customers. And, you know, Steve Jobs has been criticized for this and, you know, who am I to criticize him, right? But for the most part, you know, we do tend to impose our own biases. So, for example, and there's been some research to document this, you know, brand managers, when they think about their target market, whatever they're working in, they tend to project their own desires onto their customers. And I talk about this a lot when I do keynotes. You know, they tend to idealize who their customers are and to assume that they have certain preferences or, you know, lifestyles that are much more similar to their own than is really the case. So, it's really important to, you know, get off your butt, get out of your office and just walk around and really try to immerse yourself in what people are doing. And that includes not just in the physical world, but online as well. And again, we have these amazing technologies that allow you to do various kinds of web scraping, for example, where you're able to kind of vacuum up, you know, tens of thousands of data points, what people are talking about, what they're posting about. And, you know, if you start to get enough observations, you start to move a little bit closer towards some degree of objectivity.
I love that. So you heard it here first. You guys need to get out. Actually, hopefully you're outside already observing some consumer behavior as you're listening to this. And if not, try to do that right after we wrap up here. But Michael, this is really informative. I think people will get a lot out of this. So thanks again for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I really appreciate it. And you've asked some wonderful questions. I wish I had better answers. Mm-hmm.
Thanks so much to Michael Solomon, and thanks to all of you for putting up with my ridiculous voice in the intro and postscript to this episode. If you feel bad for me and my voice, you can rate and review us on iTunes, Stitcher, and wherever finer podcasts are sold. This episode was produced by myself and Sarah Walker Santana and was edited by yours truly and Jason Stack. Until next time, I'm Jeremy Goldman, and you've been listening to Future Proof.